Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Whoever thought America would have a shortage of baby formula? But that's what we have, and the politicians are scrambling to address public concern. We'll tell you, however, how government policies are behind the shortage and what really should be done about it. Plus, Congress will finally vote to approve $40 billion in aid requested by President Biden for Ukraine, but not without dissent from a significant chunk of Republicans. We'll talk about that. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot of the Wall Street Journal, and I'm here with my colleagues, Alicia Finley and Kim Strassel. Welcome to you both. The president triggered the Defense Production Act this week to stir faster production of baby formula. And he's also made it easier to import baby formula. Let's listen to the president.
I'm invoking what they call the Defense Production Act to ensure that manufacturers have the necessary ingredients to make safe, healthy infant formula here at home. The Defense Production Act gives the government the ability to require suppliers to direct needed resources to infant formula manufacturers before any other customer who may have ordered that good. I'm also announcing Operation Fly Formula. That's to be able to speed up the import of infant formula and start getting more formula in stores as soon as possible. I've directed the Department of Defense and the Department of Health and Human Services to send aircraft, planes overseas to pick up infant formula that meets U.S. health and safety standards so we can get it on the store shelves faster.
All right, let's talk about this. And I think the best place to start would be, Alicia, you've written about this. Just tell us how we got here. How did we get a shortage of baby formula of all essential things?
Well, I think the trigger was a recall. Abbott Laboratories in February recalled several brands of its formula, and Abbott makes up about 40% of the market. Abbott had had some problems at its facilities, you know, going back to at least last fall when there were concerns. There was a whistleblower, a former employee, complained to the FDA about its safety standards that was cutting corners and such. And so the FDA went back in January and investigated it. It did find some safety problems. There were also some issues with some complaints about infants developing a very rare but serious illnesses from this chronobacteria. Now, FDA actually says, this is interesting, that only about 2 to 4 infants actually get severely ill with this bacteria every year. And so it was concerning that all these infants appeared to have consumed the same formula from this plant.
How can the shutdown of one plant lead to such a severe shortage?
Right. The issue is that the Abbott had about 40% market share. So when you cut out Abbott, there are the 3 other producers, and they just weren't able to compensate and ramp up production enough. They're starting to. And then there's this separate issue of how does a company have 40% of the market share? And a big reason is, one, trade protections, you know, tariffs and FDA regulations that limit imports on a normal basis. And the other issue is the WIC program for low-income pregnant women and new mothers. In the states, sole source contracts, so the states provided essentially an exclusive contract to one manufacturer, which has basically given Abbott a monopoly in actually most states. And so that's why you have mothers basically scrounging around, going on scavenger hunts from store to store to find product. And many of the women until recently could still only use their WIC vouchers for Abbott formula.
WIC is the Women, Infants, and Children program. It's a long-time federal program, nutrition program for basically poor women. But it's run by the states, even though the feds provide the money. So it's astonishing, Kim, that you would, well, it should be astonishing. Maybe it isn't because we know how the government works. But the government, in the name of efficiency, sets rules so that the states could have monopolies on the formula provider as part of the WIC program. So if that formula provider goes down, then women in that state are left hanging.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because about half of all babies born in the United States qualify for WIC, which means about half of all the baby formula is being dictated by these what are called sole source contracting. And they got going more than about 15 years ago. And as Alicia says, allow states to buy below the retail price, which is good for them. They get to lower the costs of this program. But it means that whoever wins that contract is the sole supplier in that state. And so if you look out there now, Abbott has 49 WIC contracts across state and local and tribal territories. Well, the other big producer, Mead Johnson, which makes Enfamil, has 15. And those together combine for 87% of all the babies in the program across the states. And so suddenly you're in this situation, entirely government created, where you only have really two providers giving all the formula for, you know, nearly 90% of those babies in the program. And then one of those suppliers not being able to produce enough, that's how you end up with empty shelves.
It's astonishing. And it's an old story, right? I mean, so many of these economic problems that we see over the decades crop up because of some kind of government rule, some kind of government regulation, limitation, border tax. And on the border tax point, Alicia, you alluded to this. You talked about tariffs and FDA labeling rules. Why could this be the case? Because quality control shouldn't be an issue. These aren't plants in China. These aren't plants in India. These aren't plants in Indonesia. These are plants in Europe and Canada, which make formula and have presumably high quality standards themselves. But then also the FDA does inspect foreign plants that export to the United States. What is the political logic of having a tariff on Canadian formula or having FDA rules that limit the importation of baby formula?
It's purely protectionist to protect the U.S. baby formula industry and actually U.S. dairy industry, which was one of the reasons why in the USMCA deal that Trump renegotiated, or the NAFTA he renegotiated and became the USMCA, imposed tariff quotas on Canadian formula, which it had never done before. Tariff quotas are limit, put certain quotas on imports and then impose tariffs over those quotas. And the concern among the U.S. dairy industry was that Canada was going to start to attract investment, foreign investment in its baby formula product, and then would start, you know, shipping or exporting more to the U.S. and also Mexico, where U.S. basically also has a monopoly. And so this was really intended, these tariffs and these tariff quotas are really intended to protect the U.S. industry.
Well, it goes to show you here, Kim, that when you try to source everything in the United States, you're imposing limitations on the supply chain. And when that happens, when you get a problem here at home, you end up with, well, what do you know, shortages. And, you know, so the president is left to announce, okay, we're going to send special planes to go out and grab formula and ship it here in the United States, when what we ought to have been able to do is just say, hey, you know, have the marketplace adjust and have these foreign producers be able to fill the gap. They would have been more than able to do it, assuming they have enough spare production capacity. It's, again, another crazy government policy that made this happen. What about the DPA, Kim, Defense Policy, the Defense Production Act? Is that going to make any difference here?
Biden's speech was really something to behold, because here, as we've just been discussing, we have an almost entirely government-created mess, and then we have a president who comes out to propose ideas that will possibly only make it worse, but certainly won't help. I mean, listen to what Biden said there. He said, we're going to invoke the Defense Production Act to make sure that suppliers get the ingredients that they need to make baby formula. There's no problem with ingredients. That's not the issue. The issue is that there was a plant closed down because of the FDA. That plant, by the way, is still several weeks away from being opened again. They only managed Abbott and the FDA to come to an agreement on the reopening of it on Monday of this week. So marshaling more ingredients to different places will not make any difference if the issue is that you don't have a place to actually produce anything with those ingredients. And then he said, we're also going to send planes planes over to Europe to bring back baby formula. There are plenty of planes right now that fly back and forth to the United States every day, and the issue isn't transport capacity. Okay, the issue, as Alicia said, is that companies that, even if they're going to be sending it in there if in the United States, if we are going to maintain these tariffs, consumers are going to face an extra up to 17.5% tariff on the products in order to get it. That's why these formulas are not prevalent in the market. It's because of the protectionism. So, I mean, this was a bunch of nonsense out of the president's mouth. These things are not going to help at all. I know Democrats feel that they need to be doing something. They also passed some emergency aid through the House, which is just basically saying we're going to spend more money, but it doesn't matter how much money you have to spend if there's no product to buy. But if the administration really wanted to do something to help, it would immediately take those tariffs off and recognize what you said, Paul, that the issue needs to be a more free-flowing market where there's more competition.
Alicia, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, suggesting that there may be indictments that are warranted here. I guess she doesn't mean indictments of federal bureaucrats or federal policymakers who created these rules. She means private producers. Is that what the market needs?
I think this will just scare off more investment, right? I mean, that is one of the problems, is that they're just one of the reasons. It's a tertiary reason why that the market is so consolidated, is because it's still generally a low margin industry and there just hasn't been enough, you know, capital investment. I mean, and now you're going to start threatening companies if, you know, there's a bacteria found in any baby formula, which is not actually terribly uncommon. It's more the illnesses that are uncommon. If you're going to start threatening them with criminal indictments, that's just going to ward off more potential competitors and companies.
How long is this shortage going to last, Alicia?
Well, the FDA is saying that, you know, it should start to improve in a couple of months, but some of the manufacturers have said it could last all year, which obviously is not good for Democrats in November.
That is for sure. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the vote for Ukraine aid on Capitol Hill and what it tells us about the Republican Party in particular when we come back.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot here with Potomac Watch, a podcast, and I'm here with Kim Strassel and Alicia Finley. Let's turn to the vote on Ukraine aid. President Biden requested $40 billion in Ukraine aid, humanitarian aid, the government maintenance, but most of it, well over $20 billion, is going to military equipment, military aid, howitzers, anti-tank weaponry, ammunition, a variety of weaponry, and much of it is going to be for a direct purchase from the arms manufacturers. So far, Ukraine's been getting a lot of off-the-shelf things that are in stock in American supplies, and some of these now are running low, and we need to replenish our own stocks, and the bill also does that. But it supplies a lot of weaponry for Ukraine. It passed the House overwhelmingly and the Senate, but not without significant dissent from Republicans. Usually the party of strong defense and anti-authoritarian policies, but 57 House Republicans voted against the aid in the House and 11 in the Senate. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who took a trip last week with several members of the Senate Republican Conference, coming back and suggesting that there is an isolationist trend among some Republicans that he is deplored. Now, that's not the majority in the Republican Conference or the Republican Party more broadly. Polls continue to show that at the grassroots, most Republicans are solidly in support of helping Ukraine. But, Kim, what do you make of this debate in the House and the Senate and where Republicans came out?
Yeah, it's very disappointing, Paul. You know, and some of the characters here wouldn't surprise you. For instance, the guy who originally delayed this bill in the Senate was Rand Paul, who is himself a self-proclaimed libertarian who doesn't really believe in any American foreign policy. So that isn't necessarily a surprise. But it was the other 10 Republicans who many have made the argument that we shouldn't do this because we needed to put America first. And this is a kind of hangover or ongoing aspect of the Donald Trump line about make America great again. I'm not quite sure even the former president was that far removed, but this is certainly the new populist element of that. A wing is certainly taking that up and running with it. You had a number of senators saying, you know, we can't afford to be giving money to Ukraine when we should be putting money into our border, for instance. And what's really frustrating about that is, first of all, it's kind of an argument that this is binary somehow, as if we can't walk and chew gum. We obviously can both look at American priorities and deal with Americans' issues and stand up and help a very important ally in what is definitely in U.S. national interest, which is to weaken Vladimir Putin and send a warning to other rogue regimes. It's also a bit of a joke given the trillions of dollars that were just thrown out the door for COVID. There was not a lot of care in Congress at that point, especially that $350 billion boondoggle we sent to the states that is now getting used on golf courses, etc. This is a small drop in the bucket. So the relative merit of this spending is much higher, but you're not getting that level of scrutiny from these guys.
Let's listen to two of the objectors to the aid, two senators who voted no, Josh Hawley of Missouri and Rand Paul.
I think that that is an astronomical price tag. That is what the entire Ukrainian government spent running their country a year or two ago. And now we're essentially funding the whole country and we're essentially funding this war single-handedly. And I'm against nation building.
The vast majority of Americans sympathize with Ukraine and want them to repel the Russian invaders. But if Congress were honest, they'd take the money from elsewhere in the budget or ask Americans to pay higher taxes or, heaven forbid, loan the money to Ukraine instead of giving it to Ukraine. But Congress will do what Congress does best, spend other people's money. I, for one, will not. I will vote no. Somehow, somewhere, a voice of fiscal sanity must remain vigilant, must remain stalwart and steady in a sea of fiscal madness.
Alicia, give Rand Paul credit at least for consistency. He opposes just about any and all foreign aid. His view of American foreign policy seems to be that we should be Fortress America, that if we basically just settle for defenses around the United States territory, that'll be all we need. He thinks that countries have to defend themselves. It's at least consistent, although, of course, the problem is that we have done that in the past. And ultimately, when rogues are on the march, they do tend to ultimately involve, take enough territory, threaten enough of American interests that we are drawn in sooner or later. And the idea here is to aid Ukraine, who's willing to fight, so that we don't have to go in and fight, particularly to defend NATO or other aggression by Russia.
Right. And to his point, I guess his one of his complaints is that, or at least Hawley's complaint earlier, was that the entire Ukraine government was spending as much as, you know, $40 billion a couple years ago. But the country has basically been destroyed. Much of its economy has been destroyed. And it's probably in our best interest, as you say, to shore up Ukraine, help Ukraine's economy as well as defense, because that is a deterrent to other dictators, especially as we're looking at China, particularly, you know, making moves and saber-rattling with Taiwan. And if we kind of just leave Ukraine hanging out there, I think it will just encourage others, especially Taiwan, to test the waters and maybe to make an offense in the Southeast China Sea, you know, and Taiwan.
The Hawley point, Kim, on nation building, of course, is a popular one since the difficult efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. But nobody is nation building here. I mean, this is nation preservation. This is helping Ukraine to survive as a nation. And I want to underscore this point I made about the Reagan doctrine. In the 1980s, Reagan had a policy in which he was going to resist the expansion of communism around the world. And the way he did that was to have the United States support people who were willing to defend themselves. So that was in Nicaragua with the Contras, for example. That was in Africa with a couple of African nations in Angola. That was in Afghanistan, where we supported the resistance to the Russian invasion. And this allowed us to have allies who would do the fighting. And we didn't have to go in and do the fighting. Now, in Ukraine, you have a country, people who want to do the fighting to preserve their own nation. And if we do that, that's less likely, in my view, that we will have to fight to stop Putin from going into Estonia or Lithuania or Poland or somewhere else, which he possibly would do. And of course, those are all of our NATO treaty allies to whom we are committed to defend.
Yes. To your point about Holly, there was a lot of strawman in that comment, both about nation building and also this comparison of this $40 billion to Ukraine's entire budget. As you were just saying, if you break out this bill, there's about $6 billion of it that does go to training and equipment and weapons directly to Ukraine. There's also almost $4 billion in there for U.S. troops that are stationed in the region at the moment. There's also $4 billion for other countries that have been impacted by this, in particular countries on NATO's eastern flank. And then again, almost $9 billion to replenish U.S. weapons. You put that all together, and what this package really is exactly what you just described. It's kind of a fundamental example of that Reagan idea that we are going to shore up our allies in NATO who are under threat from Putin at the moment, make sure that they are able to look after their territory, put Ukraine in a position to weaken Putin and push him back. That's really what this overall package is about. And it in no way wears any relation to the United States with troops on the ground in Iraq or Afghanistan. And if we're not going to do that, we're only going to see Putin engaging in more aggression, possibly against actual NATO allies. This seems to be a smart and strategic way to go about making sure that doesn't happen.
Hard to know whether some of this is sheer partisanship. Obviously, President Biden is a Democrat. There's a kind of reflexive hostility to anything he's doing that could be factoring into some of this Republican dissent on Ukraine. But on the other hand, the Republican Party has been known for recent generations, certainly since World War II, and when the isolationist wing of the party is embarrassed and humiliated by the Nazis in Pearl Harbor. The Republican Party, the party of military strength and a vigorous American presence abroad, that is eroding, as you suggested, Kim. We'll see how much it does, but it probably will be a debate that is had in the 2024 presidential campaign, depending upon what happens here in Ukraine and elsewhere around the world. So my thanks to Alicia Finley. Thanks to Kim Strassel. Thanks to all of you for listening. Please be sure to send us a note if you want, question, complaint, whatever, at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And be sure to check out Jerry Baker's weekly podcast, Free Expression, on your favorite podcast platform. Hope to catch you tomorrow for another edition of Potomac Watch.